History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. One thing we've learned over the years is that they don't have to go untold. If we'll take the initiative to ask a few questions and take the time to patiently listen, there's really no limit to what we might learn. Our goal here is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And yes, along the way, we are not only educated, we're not only entertained, but we really can be inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. 78 years ago this week, the invasion of Sicily began. It's not something we hear about nearly as often as the invasion of Normandy, which took place nearly a year later, or some of those famous landings in the Pacific, but capturing Sicily was a very important step for the Allies in World War II, in part for the lessons learned and the roadmap it established for future operations. The code name was Operation Husky, and from July 9, 1943 till the middle of August, nearly 500,000 Allied troops from the U.S., the U.K., and Canada battled German and Italian forces for control of the island. More than 2,800 Americans gave their lives over those 6 weeks, and there were more than 7,000 additional casualties. The end result was the dethroning of a dictator in Benito Mussolini and an open door for the invasion of mainland Italy that would commence just 2 weeks after Sicily was secured. Today we're going to learn about what happened at Sicily through the memories of five different men who were there 78 years ago. They came from five different states: Michigan, Massachusetts, Colorado, South Dakota, and New York. Let's start with Jerry Countess, who grew up in Brooklyn, a recipient of the Silver Star and Purple Heart. Jerry was always convinced his closest call came on Sicily while serving with the famed 1st Infantry Division, the Big Red One. His book, Letters from the Battlefield in Love and War, centers around his lifelong connection to a nurse named Rachel.
We were close together for a year or two. She went to Brooklyn College at night, as I did. I lived on this side of town, and she lived over here. I drove my bicycle across town to her. We walked from there to back to her house, which was another mile or two, and we stayed out together until 12, 1 o'clock at night, and then I had a ride back by bike all the way across Brooklyn to the other side. But I didn't care. I was happy. And then when I got in the Army, she got word that she was accepted for the Barnett Memorial Hospital in New Jersey. When I heard that she had gotten into that school and I knew I was going overseas, I knew that if I didn't do something quick about seeing her, we weren't going to see each other, possibly never. So me and two other guys who were in the regular Army went AWOL on a Saturday morning. We got a train. We went to New York. These two guys went out and had a great time for the weekend. I saw her. She said, oh, I had to go to the school where she was in Paterson, New Jersey. I went there. I found her. Everybody was looked at me in an Army uniform. What the hell are you doing there? But I found her, and I proposed to her, and I said, okay, let's get married. We have a weekend. And she said, no, I don't want to be a widow before I'm a wife. She said, for me, marriage is something serious. I'm not going to do this for a one-night stand.
Mm-hmm.
I understood. I wasn't happy, but I understood what she said. I said, okay. And we kissed, and I got back into Manhattan. I got on the train at Penn Station, and I went back down to where he was. The train went down about 3 hours, no problem. And then suddenly the train stopped, was moved over onto a siding. Nobody knew why. We sat for over 2 hours until another train coming up from the south had to go past us. And they had to have the open road to go. Mm-hmm. So they went past us, and then we got back on. The train went back on the road. But I arrived back at Fort Lee, which is where I was at, 2 hours after Reveille in the morning.
Uh-oh.
That is precisely what they told me. Goodbye. You're going in the Army overseas. When we got on the boat, we were given guns. In basic training, we had been given 1908 Springfields.
Mm-hmm.
We did get to shoot 12 shots. That was the training with a gun.
That was the extent of your training, and now you're heading overseas with an infantry division.
When I got overseas, I didn't get a Springfield. We got the brand new M1s.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody told us anything about the guns. Just, here's your gun.
In this book, Letters from the Battlefield in Love and War, it's comprised of letters that you wrote to Ray, who you talked about, who you were in love with, who said she wouldn't marry you before you went overseas, and also to another friend of yours, and there are letters that were written to you as well. And it tells a lot of these stories, but you said one of the reasons you wrote it is you want people to know what it's really like out there.
The first thing you do when you stop walking, the absolute first thing you do, even if you only can stop for 2 or 3 hours, you dig a foxhole. Invariably, the Germans held a higher level, and you fought to take it. When you took it, then you went forward again. You're going down the mountain. You went up a one. They were higher. So they could see, not well, but they could see how many troops there were and what was going on. So if you stopped on a mountain ridge or you stopped in a low place, you were pretty sure that the Germans higher than you were watching you with glasses, telescopes. So you dug a foxhole. I was very lucky. I was short. I could dig a foxhole faster than the tall guys. As soon as you stopped and you started digging, if you were lucky, you were digging in sand. But in the mountains, you weren't digging in sand. So digging a foxhole was a very arduous thing.
But that could be the difference between life and death.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The purpose of a foxhole is to keep you below the level where shrapnel flying this way can't touch you. But if you were out of that foxhole, shrapnel flying at the height of a half a foot or a foot or whatever, you would be touched, seriously.
If I were to say, what was your closest call? Realizing that you're there in North Africa in 1943, then in Italy all the way past Germany's surrender in Europe. So you're over there a long time. I'm sure you had a lot of close calls. What was the moment where you felt you came closest to not coming home and trying to track down that special lady again?
Something that happened when we were attacking the Germans in Sicily. I saved a good part of my company. It had been was not intentional. I didn't know I was going to be doing it. Sicily is a huge collection of mountains, one after another, every way you look. Half of my company went up to the top of a certain area. And my job at that time was, I wasn't a typical fighting soldier. I was like the runner. Mm-hmm. My job was, remember, we didn't have cell phones at that time. we had a phone that was carried on a thing like this, and it worked when you turned the handle. But the battery died quickly. Sometimes it died and you didn't even know it died. It didn't always work. And even when it worked, you weren't sure you were going to get battle headquarters. They went up there and they were doing their job, you know, fighting the enemy. And all of a sudden, the Germans had new recruitment, whatever. They were really pounding on these people. Unexpectedly, these guys didn't expect to have that many people up there. They were in serious trouble. I had gone up to tell the captain something or whatever that from here, and that's what happened. Oh, my God. Look, so you could see stuff flying all over the place. He said, you got to go down and tell them. He said, otherwise, by half an hour from now, we're going to be dead. He said, go down. You're the runner. You know which way to go. You know where the group is. Go get them and tell them. So I ran down that mountain. I have to say, most of the time I wasn't running. I was flying. I jumped going down from one, maybe 20 feet, 15 feet down, landed, fell over, got up, and kept running. It was a nightmare.
With enemy fire coming in the whole time?
Coming in, but not specifically at me. It was coming all over the place.
Sure.
The real danger to that was I could have broken a leg or broken an ankle. That would have been put me into real problems.
Because then you wouldn't have been able to get out.
I wouldn't have been able to get out. And if they took over the captain and his crew up there, they were going to come down.
Yep.
And I'd have been up the creek without a paddle.
Yeah.
But, you know, lives of 10, 15, 20 guys are up there. So I had to go. I went down that mountain. I would never do that again in my life. But I was young. I was full of energy and strong and driven by the necessity. I was more frightened than if they were shooting at me specifically, just going down because I knew time was of the essence. Mm-hmm. I had to get down there as soon as I can, or if I got down a long time, they wouldn't be alive.
So you made it in time.
Made it in time. I got the guy, and they had a phone that was working. Not well, but working. They notified the artillery,
mm-hmm.
and the artillery started shooting up at there, and the guys got out. Most of them got out. A few were hurt or wounded, one or two were killed, but basically most of them got out.
So you made it. You saved their lives in the process. You avoided your life being taken. And here's another thing. You getting hit and killed, obviously, is not the ending you're looking for, but you're being captured could have been equivalent. I've heard a lot of stories from people who were captured by the Germans, if depending on where you were, if the Germans found out about your Jewish heritage, have been in the end for you.
Yeah, it might have. Absolutely. I'll tell you a story about being captured. This was when I first joined, and I really didn't know very much. Remember I told you that there were 8 different marching commands? This was maybe 3 or 4 weeks after I joined. We came to a place with a couple of mountains like this. So they gave us the command to march in a straight line, one behind the other. One platoon, 38, 36 guys, 3 or 4 squads. I was in the second squad, and we started to go up the hill. The Germans did something very clever. They stayed on both sides of where we were marching. Mm. When we went up, halfway up, they went in this way. What they did is made it impossible for the guys in the back to shoot them because our guys were in the front. Mm-hmm. The guys in the front couldn't shoot back. Of course, we were in the back. So these guys took the front group lock, stock, and barrel. They got them, and we couldn't shoot at them. They took them away. So we lost 15, 14, something number of guys like that.
So if you had been on that half of where the Germans came in?
I'd have been up the creek. At any rate, I just want to finish this story. A year and a half, 2 years later, the war ended. And I was one of the first guys to be picked to go back home because of the number of different points I had, irrelevant. So I got back and I got back on the boat, and there are a couple thousand guys on the boat, and we were very lucky. Instead of the terrible weather we had going back, this was July, the weather was beautiful, the ocean was flat, and so I got on the boat. There are a couple thousand guys in there. Nobody wanted to sleep below. It was impossible. But we stayed up on top of the boat all day. I get to the rail of the boat, and I see some people I know. We're talking, and I turn around, and I see about 15 feet behind me, there's another small group of guys talking. There's one guy standing there looking at me. We went down. We had lunch. I came back up again, and I go back to the same place, and there's the same guy there, and he's still looking at me, and he smiles. I don't know exactly what he was aiming at, but I didn't say anything. He came over to me. He said, "Hello, Jerry." He says, "You don't remember me?" "No, I don't remember you." He says, "I was in your platoon." "Not in your squad, but in your platoon." That is, platoons, 48, 50 people. So 4 squads, maybe 12 in each one. Mm-hmm. He was in the squad immediately before me on that hill. He was 2 guys ahead of me, and the Germans went between us.
Wow.
He was taken to Germany, and he worked in a German factory for almost the full 2 years making tanks.
Wow.
He says, "You can be sure that a lot of those tanks had deficiencies."
Uh-huh. He sabotaged
But them. That's where he was. So, yeah, he and a couple of other people obviously did that. But he spent the entire time that we went through all this crazy stuff, he was in a factory, getting up in the morning, working in the factory all day at night. And I asked him, I said, "Would you rather have been with us instead of in the factory?" He said, "No." I understand. But what a coincidence, you know.
Yeah, and I guess that's a, hey, that could have been me moment.
If they'd have come up a little further, I was two guys away from him.
Mm-hmm. And you were helpless, unable to fire because
couldn't
you would have been hitting
couldn't
your own
fire.
People.
Right.
I know your story has so many twists and turns, and hopefully people listening are intrigued enough that they'll go online at hometownheroesradio.com and find the links to your book, Letters from the Battlefield in Love and War. But I think we can let them know how that story ended. If you have all these letters in this book and you found them somehow, what happened with that young lady you'd asked to marry?
She was working as a nurse in a hospital without any superiors, so they had to do a lot more work. They were working 12 hours a day, 14 hours a day in the hospital. They were the nurses. When she knew she was going home, I knew that I would be going home relatively shortly. I didn't know when. The war ended. I got there. She wasn't there. She had already gone home. They had released her. So I went back to Brooklyn, and I knew the building she lived in. I knew which train went there because that's where I used to go to all the time.
Yeah.
I told her on the phone that I was coming, and when I got there, I got to the apartment house. I was very impressed by the apartment house. It was the only apartment building I'd ever seen that had an elevator in it. She lived on the ground floor. I never used it, but I was very impressed by the elevator. So I finally went down a long hall. I got to the door of her house. She had been smart enough to tell her mother and father to take a hike for a while. I got to the door. I couldn't wait. Knocked on the door, rang the bell, no answer. Knocked on the door, rang the bell, no answer. Knocked on the door, and suddenly I heard a voice on the other side. She said, "Yeah, it's me." I said, "Okay, open the door." "No." I said, "Open the door." "No." "Why?" I can't. It's been too long. I can't. I got so furious. I said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to break that door down. I'm going to back up and go charging at the door. And if I get killed trying to break through that door, I heard a click. The door was open, unlocked. And I went in. Out of a clear blue sky, one of her relatives, her older sister, had a husband who was unexpectedly rich, and he decided that he was going to make the marriage for us. And they did it in the basement of his house. They invited about 100 people, all relatives. I had no relatives. I have no sisters, no brothers, no aunts, no uncles, no cousins, nothing. It was just my mother, my grandmother, and me.
Mm-hmm. But all that time that you're overseas, all the times your life could have ended, and again, she'd already said no to you once, but it works out that you come back, you find her again, you marry, you have children and grandchildren, and all these years together. That's pretty amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I think I'm one of the luckiest guys alive.
Jerry Countess continued to believe that until his passing last year at the age of 99. His book is a fascinating read. I have that linked for you online at hometownheroesradio.com. When we come back, another infantryman who contributed to the liberation of Sicily 78 years ago. And then we'll hear from others who participated in the water, on the beach, and in the air. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.